Look, I managed to start recording before the meeting actually started. That's a huge improvement. Two strikes up for today. Okay, this is the Aries Working Group call this afternoon for October 23rd. This call is being recorded and is shared and posted afterwards to help folks catch up that cannot make it for whatever reason. But we are glad you're here. Please remember the Hyperledger Code of Conduct and the Linux Foundation antitrust policy that are in play here. Please be nice to each other and avoid doing illegal things. And that way we can all make lots of progress and get along. I'm going to again drop the wiki page for today's agenda and stuff in the list. If you'll add yourself to the attendees list, that is helpful. And I'd like to take a minute and see if anyone is new here and would like to introduce themselves. I think I recognize almost everybody.
Hello.
Hello, Javier.
Yeah, so I guess I'm one of the ones you may not recognize. I just came across Aries project like not too long ago, so I decided to join and get a bit more into the guts of this project. I joined my name is Javier, and I'm a CTO in a startup in Finland called Soma. And we are just starting with a protocol that will require these kind of tools. And then that's how I met the Aries project. And at the same time, I have noticed that there is no much information I can find about the Aries SDK Java, which I'm really interested in, so I just thought that I could join and get something from here, see if any of you could give me some pointers.
Welcome, Javier. There has not been as much movement in the Java SDK as there have been in some of the other language libraries, but we would definitely welcome contributions there. I know there has been some interest. It's not that there has been without, but I don't think there's been any code check-ins yet. But welcome. We're glad you're here. Okay, announcements. The Aries Workshop Connectathon hosted by the Sovereign Foundation is December 3rd through the 5th. Here's a link here, and on that page, there's another link. Hyperledger has stepped up to host or to help us with the facility costs. There are some other opportunities for food sponsorships that will help this out. There's also a form here to register that will help us. Help us keep track and attendance. If you are planning on coming, we ask that you please fill that out sooner rather than later so that we can get a good idea of how many people and help to arrange the other logistics that we need to. That'll be a good event. That's a developer-focused event. If you have a code base and striving to be compatible with the Aries protocols, then this would be a great event to come. Depending on the weather, it looks like we might have plenty of snow by then down in Utah. So there could be some good skiing nearby. Any other announcements? Not yet on our list.
Sam, this is Truman here quickly. This is legal code, not so much, computer code, but Sovereign Foundation is... got a set of documents about GDPR compliance that is part of the sovereign governance framework that the board just approved this morning, doing a second public review, 15 days. They a lot of input in the first group. I'll put it in the meeting pages. Sovereign governance framework homepage has links to all 8 of these documents. So I just wanted to mention that for anyone who's might be interested. I'll go get a link and stick it in there.
I appreciate that, Drummond. That would be excellent to have in there. Okay. Related meetings review. I don't see Mike. Do we have any updates on IRSA? Cam, I do see Brent and Cam.
No update.
Okay. Semantics or DUX?
Yeah, maybe I can throw a few words. So regarding the semantics and ODCA, as you know, we are running right now a pilot with Novartis, and we already published a tool for parsing data structure. So you can basically get JSON ODCA structure directly from Excel file. And currently we are building a tool which will allow you to design those structures directly from the user interface, means that you can basically create some inputs, design the form, and then out of it, it will be generated JSON OD structure for the ODCA. And other way around means that you can upload JSON OD and then generate directly the UI. So this will be very handful for developers and different frameworks, that you can automatically generate the form for your application directly from the data structure, which you will receive probably from the digital wallet or something. So that's the part on the semantic side. In the context of DIT UX, so we had yesterday a call where we discussed different approaches for the identity. I gave a presentation about ID proofing and through the signals and artifacts. And basically we are working right now on the different personas, which we basically borrow from sovereign documentation about how to validate the different workflows for different persons. And we are trying to design a kind of diagram flow for onboarding and enrollment from the UX perspective. Obviously the links which are still valid there, you can find more information about what happened there with some notes. Thanks.
Awesome. Thanks, Robert, for reports on both of those topics. Indie contributors. Or the identity implementers call.
Since nobody saying anything, I just forget about one thing, if I may. Within this Novartis project, there is basically there are two companies which are working on the digital wallet part. There is Asperity and the Swisscom, and one is coming from the perspective of Ethereum code base, and one is coming from the Indie SDK. And right now we have a discussion about if they should together migrate towards Aries SDK instead of going for the Indie SDK and basically continuing on the, let's say, old code base. And obviously we advise them to look for Aries and the Aries RFCs and the specifications which we are working within here. I will have, I think tomorrow or within 2 days, we'll have the discussions about that with all folks there. And if someone will have like additional arguments to go for Aries SDK, I will really appreciate that so we can push that forward. Thanks.
Sam, I believe the Indie implementers call is tomorrow.
I don't know why it says next week. Is it biweekly?
It is biweekly, and I believe next up is tomorrow's.
That's right. Okay. And thank you, Robert. I said something, but I was on mute. Thanks for the updates, and hopefully as we have repos created for Aries SDK work now, and so we should have work beginning in those repos sooner rather than later, which is a really nice step forward. Okay, I did not yet copy notes from this morning's work updates. That's something that I neglected to do. And I know BCGov 033 is available a couple of weeks ago, and you're working on performance. Is there any other updates you wish to share?
Do you mind if I talk for a moment about storage performance a bit and what we're finding?
Yes. If it's a super longer topic, let's pick it up at another time. But if you have a couple things to share, that would be useful.
Okay. So what we're basically finding is the very high volume of tag and inserts that are occurring as a result of storing the protocol message state in non-secrets. So we're try to attack that and figure out how best to do it. The things we're thinking about as we transition into from the wallet being in the Indy SDK to being agent managed storage, AMS in Aries, is the difference between native. One of the things is we want to eliminate the difference between what's in the Indy SDK now of native versus pluggable. We'd like to get a simpler interface where more happens behind the pluggable part of it. So right now there are a number of calls for storing items and then the related tags versus a single call that would say, here's my item, here's my tags, and you store it, so that the pluggable interface can figure a better strategy. So we're looking at different ways of using settings in Postgres to make it more efficient. So we'd like to give the pluggable interface more control over it, and so try to keep the security pieces on the API calling side, but the caller should have more ability to take advantage of the capabilities of the data store they're using. So those are the main things we're finding, and we'll keep investigating. But basically right now, the calls seem to be efficient enough, but there's just so many being made that we think that's the big slowdown. So there you go.
Appreciate those findings, and appreciate your work in speeding these things up. Protocol state is something that we haven't deeply discussed, but we should. And so having your understanding there about the right ways to accommodate those needs is a really good answer.
One more brief comment on that, which is that right now I think we're putting connections in non-secret storage, and I think connections need to become sort of a first-class entity. Connection being a relationship between two DIDs that are created through DID exchange. I think it needs to be something that is, I put a note on this in one of the Aries tickets, or actually I created a new ticket on this, and I'd like to get a discussion going on that of how we make that a first class item that is portable across Aries implementations.
Strong agree on that one. So we'll look at that ticket this week and we'll bring it up in a meeting if that will help that conversation move along.
Sounds great.
Troy, Aries Framework Go.
Hey, good timing. I was late and just joined.
Excellent.
Yeah. So I mentioned this morning, so I guess this is a recap for most people that were there. So we posted our usual planning notes from our 10:30 weekly meeting on Tuesday. Everybody's welcome. The note this week is we added support to the DID exchange invitations for ledger-based DIDs, not just the underlying peer DIDs. So we've tested that against Sidetree protocol. You can see the details at diff. We have kind of a fake mock implementation that's in the BDD tests in the Aries Framework Go repo. We also have a fabric-based implementation that's running externally. You can click through the links to see that. And Stephen also pointed out that, you know, maybe we should create an issue for help wanted for adding Indy support. So I've pointed that help wanted issue there as well.
Awesome. Thank you, Troy. Jack, here's SDK Ruby.
Yeah, Sam, this is just a recap of this morning as well. So there is a article on RubyFlow now, with the link in, that changed since this morning's meeting. And there was a update of the gem, just some minor improvements, but also a Rails project sample of using the gem that is now up on GitHub there.
Awesome. Thank you, Jack, for your work there in reporting. .NET, AriesFramework.net. Okay, and then any Python, Java, or JavaScript updates?
Yeah, I feel like we didn't give Javier a great amount of detail on the Java stuff. I don't know if any Java folks are on here. The people that are working on that are in time zones where this particular meeting is not very convenient. Which Indie Chan or which Aries channel is likely to find those people so Javier can connect with them? Does anybody know where the Aries SDK Java people hang out?
Hi, this is Moshmi. I usually run the Aries SDK Java.
Oh, good. Okay.
Zoom calls, and it usually happens on Wednesday nights. And we definitely, it'll be really helpful if people can participate. Right now, it's just me and Shikalko.
Okay, great. So, Javier, now you have at least one person you can connect with. You can use the Zoom chat to talk to Mushmi about specific times of those meetings.
Yeah, and we are open to changing the times if it's not suitable for the broad audience.
Yeah, that's great. Thanks. At least I have now some way of connecting with somebody. That's perfect. Thank you.
Cool.
Excellent. Thank you, Daniel, for facilitating that. Any other code updates?
For JavaScript.
Specific on, yes, Kate, go ahead, please.
Okay, yeah. So we are starting, we had been meeting, we changed our day, we're meeting to Fridays, as you can see. We've basically started with a code base that Jacob has worked on that was modeled after the Cloud Agent Python. And we're currently trying to, there are about four of us contributing the call. Others obviously are welcome, but we're starting to try to work on enhance that code base to include some, how would we add the connection protocol, for example, or certain RFCs that are of most interest to us. So welcome others to join that. That's about it.
Thank you for updating those links. Yeah. And then there was it AJ? Was going to say something?
No, that's it. The same thing Keith mentioned.
Oh. Perfect. Thank you. Any work updates that we missed? Indy? I didn't call out Indy. I know Richard usually is the one to report there, and he is not on the call today. Okay. Any other work updates? Upcoming releases. Okay, I'm not hearing any. On our agenda today, we have a couple of topics. And first, we're going to start with an architecture diagram. Daniel Hardman is going to talk through that. And then we're going to talk through the issues surrounding the data exchange protocol that need to be resolved before that can be in regular use and accepted. And then some test suite conversations. So Daniel, do you want to share?
Yeah, if I could just share real quick.
Please.
Okay. So there have been a number of conversations where people have said, well, what part of the architecture are we talking about? And Nathan, I think, was the first one to recommend that we build some kind of a map that we could actually point at when we're having conversations. So I took that wish list item and spent a little bit of time and came up with a diagram. And I'm not intending to talk through the diagram in great detail right now. I just want to make people aware that it exists and solicit feedback about it. I might go open a, maybe I'll open an issue in, well, I'm not sure which repo to put an issue in. Maybe I'll just talk about it on the Aries channel in Rocket Chat. This is the basic diagram, and then I've got kind of a call out for each part of the diagram to show what I think it means. For people who are new to this world, the thing that we call an SDK has also been called a core. And the SDK would encompass things like the language wrapper, C callable APIs, and things down below it, but not an agent or a framework that sits above it. And it's not clear whether most people that show up will actually want an SDK, or whether they will want to work at the higher level. We're kind of predicting they'll work at the higher level. Anyway, so that's about all I wanted to say. I just asked for 2 minutes of time to make people aware of it. The link is to this diagram is in the agenda, and I'll repost this on Rocket Chat.
So Daniel, are you looking for feedback on that diagram specifically, or in the general process of a roadmap?
On the diagram, the goal here is to come up with something that allows people to get their head in the right part of the architectural space when we have a conversation. We pull up the diagram and say, we're talking about this part of things, and we can kind of examine, you know, assumptions. We probably also want to reconcile the diagram against the repo structure that we have, so that people can say, oh, I'm in this repo. Oh, that's what this means. So that would be a secondary benefit if we can get some alignment around the diagram.
I love it. I'd also love to be able to show maybe a higher level to the diagram, which will help highlight the places where protocols show up, you know, in communicating between agents and things like that. And so I think there's actually a couple of things. A higher level, this will be the drill into the SDK piece, and perhaps a bit of a stack when it comes to DIDCOMs, I think would be useful there as well. I wonder if this, when we get it to the point where it makes sense, would live really well in an RFC, and that way it's really easy to pull up and point to. Any thoughts there?
So there is an RFC that John Jordan and Drummond have been working on in the background that describes the entire stack. This diagram that I'm talking about is not the whole four-layer stack that Drummond and John talk about. This is just what is the world of Aries, which is probably just the middle two layers of that four-layer stack. So it's a little bit more detailed. There probably needs to be a reconciliation against that. This diagram could appear as a detail diagram inside the RFC that has the larger context, or we could write a separate RFC for just it. I don't have an opinion yet. I'll let that stew.
Awesome. I appreciate your work there and volunteering that effort.
Okay, I'm pasting the link to the diagram in the Zoom chat.
Awesome. And it is already in the agenda for those that want to look it up there. Okay. Last week, it was with enthusiasm suggested that we focus on DidExchange and figuring out the related things that that we need to fix about the DidExchange protocol before it can move ahead with it. So we're looking at Aries RFC 23. The data exchange protocol, this is designed to be, when completed, is designed to be the successor to the connection protocol that is currently in use. There's a link to that here. There's a couple of main issues that I want to bring up, and then if there's any that I've missed, we can bring those up as well. One issue is the format of the invitation. There was a discussion at IAW that was led by the Spaceman ID group, where we talked about that. Tomislav was also present, and a few others, where we talked about the right way to handle these types of links for the maximum amount of interoperability. And I like the idea of having that RFC that we can sort of have a smaller section here and describe how the implementation applies, and then point to the other RFC for all of the other details that relate. I've reached out to the Spaceman folks and don't have a response yet, but I'm hoping that we can promote that work and bring it along. It's not massively different, but there's a couple of important items of nuance as it relates to this. One of them, of course, is that this needs to not be CI, which stood for connection invitation, because this can be generalized to a lot more than just connection invitations that are being passed here. So that's one issue, and I don't know that we have a resolution on that yet without focus on the other RFC, which should be hopefully coming along pretty quick. Another issue brought up was that it is useful when we're passing a DID document itself. This is useful in the case that that you are passing a peer DID, of course. that the DIB document not be passed as a JSON structure, but be passed in something that can signed more easily. And so part of that discussion as well, if I've got here's a list of open issues, by the way, around this that mentioned this particular RFC. But there was a discussion here in ticket 243 about sending the DIDDoc as bytes and the JSON structure. And one of the things that actually came up here was that we could, if we attach or use the attachment mechanism, we can actually add signing to the attachment decorator design so that the attachment itself can be signed pretty easily. And that actually cleaned up a couple of things. Before we had talked about the concept of being able to sign a portion of a message as opposed to the whole message. And this is a particular case where there's a piece of the message that needs to be signed with a particular key that's important to bootstrap the peer did process. We had this discussion and we all kind of agreed and then nothing actually, I believe hit any of the RFCs. Does anyone have any new information on this?
Good summary. I agree with the status and we just need to get to closure by raising some PRs.
So to get a little more crisp about what needs to happen, we need to amend or propose an update to the attachment decorator to allow signing of attached items.
I can take that one.
Awesome. And then if we do that, the nice part is that there's no signature decorator that we have to mess with, which was a little bit of a controversial item while we're trying to figure that out. And signing attachments seems like a super solid way to the attachment needs anyway. So that feels like a really good approach. If we do that, then the DID doc that's actually going to be passed is going to be probably passed in Base64 because that's the way attachments work. Is that the understanding of everybody?
Yeah.
And then the signature that's applied will be against that Base64 string, not anything inside of it, which meets the needs of the connection protocol well. And the result of it is that this whole connection block would end up needing to be in that attachment, not just the DID doc. I have mixed feelings about that. Mostly just because the DID doc is the thing that we really need to sign from that perspective. But there's some questions about whether, you know, the DID, if there's a DID doc, the DID is often appears here, but is a pure DID. And not including that in the signature feels really weird. From a pure DID perspective, Daniel, does it matter that we're signing the whole connection, or do we need to individually sign the DID doc in order to make this work?
No, signing the DID doc doesn't actually improve security from the pure DID perspective. I haven't thought about it from other perspectives, but as far as pure DID is concerned, we don't need a signature on the DID doc. We just need a signature on, we just need authenticated encryption around the message. So the notion of signing here does alleviate a complication, but we don't actually need the signature part for peer DIDs.
Interesting. So the idea here was that in the exchange request was probably not the right here, but in the response, you'd want to verify that the document that came back was actually signed with the same key that was present in the invitation, correct?
Actually, you should be able to use a different key. The thing that you have to sign with is the key that's in the DID document, not necessarily the key that was in the invitation.
But you want to know that the person that's giving you the DID doc is the key holder of the invitation as well?
Yeah, so that would make sense. But that's a characteristic of the protocol, and the signature would be around the message on the protocol. It's not a characteristic of the peer DID method. Does that make sense? The peer DID method doesn't care how an invitation triggered an exchange. It only cares about the exchange itself. I'm not saying that it's irrelevant to do a signature. I'm saying that the signature that we're talking about getting assurance from goes on a message as a whole. The one that is on the individual DID document is not important.
Okay, so it might be that the signature doesn't actually solve our problem then. But the advantage of this, right, about having the signature here was that the invitation is not really a full DID doc. It's just enough to bootstrap the process.
Yeah.
So the response is the first time that a fully formed DID doc is actually passed from one peer to another peer. And so that's sort of like the initial state of that interaction. And we want to make sure that that hadn't been man in the middle in any way. And that was the original design behind actually signing the connection block with the key used in the invitation.
So there's the challenge here is that there's two different kinds of assurance. We have to be really crisp about them. There's the assurance that you want that the party who gave you the invitation is actually the party you're connecting with. And that's what you've been talking about. There's also the assurance that the party who's produced the DID doc is the party that owns the DID. And that's a different kind of assurance. So the party that owns the DID producing the DID doc is guaranteed by that party being the responsible party for the third message in this protocol, second and third, the request and the response. That message needs to use authenticated encryption, and the key that does the encryption needs to be associated with the DID doc that's being passed. You could do it in addition or instead by signing the entire message with the key of the owner of the DID doc. But that is a different key from the one and gives you a different assurance from the one that is related to the original invitation. So if we need both of those assurances on the protocol, we have to affix two signatures.
So authenticated encryption solves the assurance of DID ownership if the message actually came signed with the keys that are present in the DID doc, right?
If it came either signed or encrypted with the keys that are in the DID doc, then we know that the owner of the DID doc is behind the revealing of the DID doc.
Yes, so that one is solved, and thank you for clarifying my verbal misstep there. So that one happens without signing the connection block at all, as long as the message actually showed up and you can line up the key used in authenticated encryption with what's present in the DID doc, which is what we currently propose in the protocol. So the other type, so I believe that one is solved. In the second one is assurance that we're getting this response message from the same person that offered the invitation originally.
Right, and that one you might need the signature block for.
Right. So in this case, the signed attachment, if we're going to move to an attachment instead of doing this separately, then the signature on the attachment would be not necessarily the same key that was used in the invitation, that's in the DID document. It would be used by the key that's actually in the invitation.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you. I was focused on one side of the problem. You were focused on the other. Both sides are important. Now I'm realizing how confusing it is to somebody who's just landing in the conversation. We should probably draw a diagram that shows all these different parties and which signature is associated with which one and where it goes.
Yeah, Daniel, this is Daryl. I'll jump in as being the first volunteer to say I'm confused.
You're probably the only one in the whole world that's confused, Daryl.
That's my state of being, dude.
No, I promise. There's others that I'm sure are confused here. There's definitely pieces of this that we need to make sure line up, and part of it is drawing directly from the text of the original protocol itself. What I think we need to do is we need to make sure that the discussion of the various assurances is clear in the RFC itself, and that becomes the place that we point people to. And if they have questions from there, that means we need to clarify the RFC. Since that needs to sort of be the The protocol definition that explains why things are the way that they are.
Yeah. Okay, so we've got a second action item besides updating the attachment RFC. We need to update this RFC, and we need to add assurances, and we probably need a diagram that, you know, shows arrows saying this piece of content is signed by this party, kind of a thing, so that it all makes sense. So who should do that part?
I'll start there. I'll volunteer for that piece. And update any of the language that we need, or produce a diagram and try to clarify the various assurances in play. And then I'll do that, Daniel, based on your updating of attachments. So all okay. This will change to the attachment method.
Okay. I can have the attachment part done before the end of the workday. So if you want to wait for that, then you can go as soon as I've got that part ready.
Perfect. And then the third thing that we need to happen that I'm aware of is the invitation exchange format and how that URL is to be constructed and handled, which is the RFC. And I will take the action item of chasing down the Spaceman guys to fulfill on their commitment at IW to write that up as an RFC. There wasn't a ton of controversy, but there's some detail that came up in the conversations. It was not that different from what we have here and what our previous conversations mentioned, but there was some detail in the conversation that I think is really valuable to understand. And so having that in an RFC is really valuable that way. So I will be chasing that down from the Spaceman ID folks. And then I can similarly update this based on the appearance of that RFC, so that we can similarly refer to it in the right concepts. So those are three things that need to be updated. And really there's two separate, there's the updating of attachments and the updating of the URL RFC. And then there's updating this RFC to match the changes made in those other places. Are there any other changes or deficiencies that need to be addressed in the Data Exchange protocol? That's still a question, but I should mention a recent change that is important. And that is that in the request that's sent, so the invitation is first, and that could be implicit if it's a public DID. And then the change that has been made after discussion and issues is that the parent thread ID in the language currently in the RFC says must. The thread decorator is present and specifies the parent thread ID that is either the ID present in the invitation itself, or is the DID URI of the DID itself that prompted the sort of the creation of the implicit invitation, such that when this exchange request is received, the receiver can use the parent thread ID to understand its origin as either an implicit one from a public DID, or as originating from a specific invitation that was created and shared. And so that's one of the recent changes that's been made to this after some discussion and in issues. So any questions about the parent thread idea and concept?
Can I just comment on that, Sam?
Yeah.
So what prompted this is we were having a discussion about introductions. There's an introduction protocol, and the end of the introduction protocol is the beginning of this protocol. And the question was, well, how do I know that this invitation is coming from the introduction protocol that just happened? And we were talking about how you make connections. What we had originally had here was that the invitation message has an ID, and that becomes the ID of this thread that includes the invitation, request, and response. But the problem is that if you have an invitation that is a blanket public invitation, that's that the ID in the invitation is not going to be helpful because, you know, the same invitation could be used a million times. A million people could connect with Taylor Swift or something. So don't ask me why Taylor Swift popped in my head. Anyway, so the theory is that the invitation is actually a parent of the thread where the DID exchange is happening, not a direct, it's not the ID of the thread itself. So you make an invitation, you could make it to a single party, or you could make it to the world or some subset thereof. And there's an ID on that invitation, and that ID on the invitation shows up as the parent thread ID on the thread for the exchange request and response. So you know what invitation you're dealing with.
Some additional backstory there. There's also the keys that are in use for the invitation that you could use to look that up, but there was a desire expressed to make that stronger so that the key was not the only mechanism that you could use to do so. And that's what ended up prompting this. And might I add that I think this is a perfect use of the parent thread ID, because that way you have a whole bunch of child threads, if you will, that can point to the parent thread. And we had that in concept, but this is the first time where it's you showed up in a really strong way. Any other comments around the parent thread? The thing to note here is that this ID would be the thread ID of this thread itself, which is the, you know, exchange request and response. And then in that, in the response, the parent thread no longer needs to be present. This can be the thread ID of the message of the request itself. Okay. No questions about the parent thread. That was widely discussed. I think it was a really good conversation and suggestions. I forget exactly who suggested that. It may have been Paul, but really, really good. Are there any other issues besides the three that we've talked about that need to be corrected before people are comfortable moving forward with this particular protocol?
Do we have is in this RFC, do we talk about using the service decorator so that you could connect, you could be invited to connect with something through something that's not a known DID?
We do.
Okay.
But it's striking me that we need to be, we said up here that we're, they use the service decorator, but then we're not actually using the service decorator in the invitation examples.
That's probably why I was asking it, and my subconscious was saying, wait a minute, something doesn't seem like it's all the way complete here. So, okay. So we just need to put those three keys under a services or service decorator. Is that right?
I believe that's the case, but I don't know that the service, I wrote the service decorator RFC, and I'm not actually sure it's received really that much review. And so it could probably benefit from some eyes.
It is being used.
It is being used, but that doesn't necessarily mean it's all a good idea.
True, but it's being used.
So the service decorator is 56. And the idea behind the service decorator, this is what it should look like in this other example. And I've added myself another task, by the way, to update 23, to update the examples to use the service decorator. And so the idea behind the service decorator is that this is the relevant information that you would find in a DID document under a service, endpoint that allows you to communicate with someone. So if you don't have a DID document yet because you haven't exchanged one, or there's not a public DID that you can use to direct someone to look one up, this would pass the service decorator in line which then could allow the recipient to act as if they had pulled out this out of a DID document and then send a message using the recipient keys, the routing keys, and the service endpoint in play. That's the idea here. And so this is a general way of doing this. The reason why this actually showed up in a decorator by itself is because Tobias was proposing some uses outside of invitations that actually needed to pass the service information along when you're communicating with someone that you have not yet exchanged DIDs with, but still want to communicate in that secure manner. And so there's a handful of open issues here. One of them is the key formats actually used in place, which is sort of a dependent issue. I know there was some discussion about that in the last couple of weeks or months. Is there anyone who can shed some color? I know Tobias was here earlier. Is there anyone who can talk about the state of the key format here?
Well, I can just mention that there's intense debate going on inside the DID working group on that particular topic at W3C circles. People are debating whether we use JWKs, we use JSON LD key registry format, or we use something different, or all of the above, and it has not been decided.
Yeah, I'd say a third of yesterday's DID working group call got devoted to the subject, and by the end of that discussion, it was like, well, that was round one of probably what's going to be a 15-round fight.
Awesome. The particular concern I have about the key format is that we're trying to make this stuff small enough to shove into a URI, which means that getting lengthy doesn't help us. Having a compact form of the key encoding is a really valuable thing in this particular case. If we keep it hopefully semi-short, it means you can pass the entire message in a QR code. If we get to ridiculous lengths, you start to get to the point where we can make a QR code, but it's really difficult to scan just because of the density of the QR code. And then you're more or less forced into using something like a URL shortener, which has some privacy implications of doing so. You know, being able to pass just the message in the QR code itself would be really, really handy there. So.
Well, that's important input to the key description discussion. Because, at least what I took away from yesterday that I've anticipated for this while, it's basically JOTS, based on the Jose stack and they're well established, it's already an IETF standard, right? How key description works there and how you extend it, add new key descriptions to a registry versus all the other ways and a more flexible JSON LD based way of describing keys. And that's what certain folks would like to avoid because it's like, well, it's could be an interop nightmare. It's important. I'd say any input that the Aries community has that feels strongly about that would impact that we should make sure that's represented on the group. There are a number of us that are on that, so I think it probably fairly well is, but any specific arguments that you feel need to be made, make sure that they're clear.
Drummond, are you saying that what's highlighted on the screen now would be a JOT?
Well, certainly the argument specifically coming from Mike Jones or being led by Mike Jones, who is a co-editor of the JSON, I think it's JSON Web Key specification, is to allow only JSON Web Key based descriptions. Yeah, in a DID doc, and have everyone rewrite their key descriptions so there's just one way of doing all key descriptions.
That's specific to the DID doc, though. That doesn't necessarily impact this because this is an application layer.
I was only talking about DID doc.
Yeah, the problem though is the whole point of the service decorator is to replicate as close as possible the service endpoint information so that you could use it as if you had retrieved it from a DID doc. So there's right. Sort of a like dependency here.
Right.
Now, maybe that's a foolish goal, right? Maybe that's not great because the DID doc needs to be a little more precise here, but we need to know the same information. And if we're going to pass, if you're going to pass a message using didcoms but not actually have a diddoc pre-exchanged, then you're going to need to know the same information that's in a service endpoint. So trying to mimic this as close as possible, I think, is a really good plan. But now we have this issue of the fact that, you know, I looked up to see the JWK format. Here is the full format actually provided. And there may be a compact form of this, but, you know, this is huge compared to just actually dropping a key itself. But we have the issue of needing to be able to understand the nature of those keys. There's both the key type and the encoding that are useful in there. So, you know, without reading the entire doc.
There was a separate issue that I opened and I closed it again, but maybe we should reopen it, where I was talking about, are there ways that we could minify an invitation so that we could not end up with such a large payload that has to be turned into a QR code. I kind of concluded that all the ways of minifying that I knew of were kind of weak. They didn't help very much. They only helped maybe 10, 20%, and it wasn't worth it. But maybe we should reopen that and somebody clever will come along and say there's a way to minify better.
Well, I think the biggest thing is, I mean, you have to pass the public key, right? I mean, there's no avoiding that in all those places, and you have to pass enough information so the person knows what type of key it is. I think whatever those techniques are, so I think the multi-codec might maybe do that, or I can't remember which one that Manu proposed for doing that. Seems to be the minimum we'd have to do.
So the blue highlighted text here is worse than what we would have to show for most ED25519 keys. With ED25519, I believe we don't have to, well, first of all, neither of them really needs the KID, because the KID is only relevant if you're going to dereference it in a document or something. So we could just give, I think on SECP256, we could just give X and Y. On ED25519, we may just be able to give X.
So but you have to know what X is. You have to know the algorithm, don't you?
You have to know that it's ED25519.
Right.
Yeah,
that's
what I mean.
I'm sorry, the CRV is ED25519, yeah.
So I would think you'd need... Yeah, I mean, you need the key and the...
We should be passing around Montgomery keys, which aren't registered in JWKs.
Can you say unpack that a little bit, Kyle?
So what we're using these keys for are going to be ECDH operations. And so there's a conversion operation that's happening in Indy SDK. So there's some fancy math, basically, that converts from an ED25519 key to an X25519 key. They're basically just different curves that are better for certain operations. And so we probably want to be passing around X25519 keys because that's the actual form that you need to use in the operation. And this goes to the discussion that's happening in the JWE right now, which is, should we be using signing keys only for signing, and should we be using driving keys only for driving? And so in this case, this would be a drive only key. Sounds like I've lost people. Essentially what I'm saying is we wouldn't be using ED25519 keys.
But it also strikes me as unlikely that we'd all be able to settle on exactly one key format, which means we still need to specify the key format.
Correct. Yeah. So you still need that. But what I'm saying is, I guess, probably a little bit pedantic.
Well, what you said, Kyle, made me immediately think this is all driving me crazy. I'm sure I'm not the first to make that particular crypto joke.
Here's the moral to the story. There's more information. The JWK is more verbose than what we're doing now. We might be able to eliminate some parts of its verbosity, but probably we're going to make the invitation bigger than it is today if we go down a JWK route. How much bigger is unclear. Maybe 50% bigger, maybe 20% bigger, who knows?
So that means pretty much that we have to go to redirection, shortening and redirection.
Which kills me.
Well, there's a couple of things to think about. You don't have to, so this just could be viewed as a disadvantage of being in ephemeral mode with QR codes, that particular combination. And we could say, yeah, it's possible to do, but your QR codes end up really big. So either don't use QR codes to communicate ephemeral connections, use some other method, or establish a connection, in which case the invitation can be smaller because you don't need the service decorator.
It can be. The argument backfires slightly when the ephemeral mode has to be used to establish a connection, and now you have that problem. So here's what we should do. I am going to explore the use of JWK in this particular format to represent what we currently have and see if I can come up with some samples or some sort of exploratory sizes on what we're looking at. For example, if we're going to produce a QR code based off of a URI formed in this way, the minimum possible size is X, and the maximum can be up to Y depending on what you actually use. And that will help inform the argument. The thing that makes me uncomfortable here is that I felt like we were super close on the signing of attachments. We solved that problem in a really nice way. And the URL RFC, the Spaceman ID was working on, I think is also not really contentious. We know what to do there, which means that we know how to apply those things to the DID exchange protocol. The service decorator seems to be the big thing that's hanging around because of the goal of having the service block represent what you might pull out of a DID document. So I have a question here. I think the goal of having the service decorator actually mimic a DID document is holistically good, but maybe timeline impractical with the ongoing conversations around DID docs themselves. Is it worth trying to pick something that we think will be easier to work with in the future as we go forward and then just lock it and remove the strict dependency on DID documents? That would unlock us, but not get us to the goal of having the service decorator perfectly mimic what is in a DID doc.
I think that's probably reasonable because we're not trying to use it in a way that you're that have the same attributes of a DID doc. You're just trying to do, here's how to respond to this one message. That's it.
It does have a narrower application. Certainly, if you back up a little bit, they look like the same. But you might have a point that we're not necessarily to try to solve all of the same problems. I worry about a dependent thing because suddenly they come along, and you know, for example, there used to be a way to refer to services or keys in DID documents, and then we came up with DID URIs, and now there's like a different way. So I'm mildly leery of not being able to make forward progress with this. So what I guess I'm proposing is we just pick something that we think might be in the future, but I change the text of the service decorator RFC to say this is designed to perform the same functions as the information required in a DID doc, even though that format may be slightly different. And that way, at least in the short term, we're not under pressure to keep them aligned. And a future version, as we move forward and things get more stable on the DID doc side, a future version could actually make some corrections to bring it in closer alignment. Any support or opposition to that approach?
I think that's good. I wish Tobias was on the line because I'm looking the work that Matter Global did for BCGov on the OAuth. OIDC stuff. He's used a proof request combined with a service decorator, and as a result, it was far too large and wound up having to use a redirection anyway. So the other thing you got to keep into that I think about is that when you attach a service decorator on something, you're attaching it to some other message, and the chances of that message being small maybe may not help us either, because it may not be small enough that the combined is small enough to fit in a QR code anyway.
So
and you're back to a redirector.
What's our limitation on a QR code in terms of characters? Do we know that?
I think it's around 2,000. I think that's close enough to say that's realistic on most.
That's actually running into the common limit on URI length too, is around 2,000 characters. There's a density issue with QR codes, and there's also a factor in QR codes that you can adjust that affects how much damage the QR code can sustain and still be readable. And it may be that we... that in order to get it to be scannable in real world conditions, we end up having to drop. The thing is, this is being displayed on a screen, and you can assume that the screen has not been damaged perhaps in this exchange, which means that we may be able to reduce the data redundancy in the QR code format and then drop a level. The more you shove into a QR code, the smaller the individual blocks get, because more blocks have to show up in the same image space, and that's the concern. Let me do a little bit of research on this and see like what those practical limits are, not only of QR code scanning, but exploring the minimum uses of encoding these things in various ways. And it might be that we're chasing an impossible task here. I squirm at the idea that there's no way to do a URI as part of an induction without using a redirection service, because there's a huge privacy loss component that we don't have to suffer if we keep it purely within a QR code.
You also lose all of your offline use cases.
Yes, Kyle, that's an excellent point. There's no offline URL redirectors.
Yeah, we need to have it work offline.
We really do.
So I hate to bring this one up, but I
go for it, Kyle. Just go for it.
Just lay it on us.
What are we doing about the man in the middle stuff with Did Exchange?
This is Tobias's signing the invitation, right?
That doesn't solve the problem. If you look at Sven's analysis on this in the peer did method, we had to do certain requirements in order to prevent a man in the middle attack. And that's where the QR code and the verifiable credential aspect of it came into play. But if we require that in the did exchange, that's turning it from a 2-point or a three messaging scheme to at least a 5, typically could be 4. And
extends out the protocol is what you're saying.
Yeah, I'm more than anything. The question is, should we be talking about that in the did exchange? Because right now, that's where the man in the middle attack occurs.
The current RFC describes the invitation as being out of band. And so I believe I'd have to find the text, but I believe that we talk about that being, you know, needing to protect that, in a QR code sense. That means that the QR code cannot be observed. So if someone's got a camera in the room, you know, and they're watching your phone and they happen to see the invitation as the other person is scanning it, that would be a form of observation and, you know, in an out of band communication. If the invitation was passed in some other way, like a slide, for example, it's intended to be observable by multiple people in the room, and there's a low level of assurance when they actually use the invitation to generate a did exchange that the did they're getting is actually me. The classic example of this, let's say, is that I have a poster that has an invitation. You know, I'm Subway, and I'm inviting you to connect. You know, create a connection to Subway, and I have a poster with an invitation QR code. Someone just prints out a new invitation pretending to be Subway and prints it on a sticker and then applies it over the poster. And most people just assume that Subway would need to update the thing. And so they stuck a sticker on it. And now someone can can effectively man in the middle that relationship in a way that that's hard to solve. So I believe what we'd done previously to in order to get the connection protocol working at all was to sort of punt on that concept. It's helped a little bit by the fact that this is called data exchange and not really, you know, trust confirmation or even the connection protocol implied that you trusted the connection after you it was complete. And so one of the things that could be done is a protocol used for the automatic detection of man in the middle. That's difficult unless you involve sort of out of band confirmations, or like Kyle, you explained, you know, there's a lot more steps to the did exchange protocol to prevent man in the middle from occurring.
One of the things we talked about, about in doing that was including a proof as part of did exchange. In other words, the parties would not wait for a proof request, would just construct and send a proof that could be verified by the other party. So that allows did exchange or a verifiable exchange, verifiable credential exchange without needing another message. So that's one of the things we talked about, the rich schema as the ability to have signed signed self-attested credentials. So that again could help out because we could make sure we're there's nobody in between the prover and the verifier. So those are a couple of things we talked about.
Yeah, those and those are what I'm afraid of is they're the best solution we have, which as Daniel pointed out in when we were discussing this a few months ago, if we're requiring that in the DID exchange, that typically means that we're making this exchange very heavyweight. And so then it comes down to the question of, are we willing to accept that heavyweight in the beginning in order to make this a long-lived connection, whereas something like TLS is operating under the assumption of it's been designed to be very lightweight because it wants to produce quite a few connections. And so this is where we have to make trade-offs as to what are the properties we want out of it in order to get certain guarantees. And by it, I mean out of the key exchange protocol.
I would prefer the DID exchange is as light as possible. And then any application of trust is actually a separate protocol. Is either, you know, you exchange stuff, you know, after the fact, or there's extra protocols that, to verify the lack of a man in the middle, et cetera, that then are used. And in practice, it might be that everyone immediately does did exchange, immediately followed by this, you know, another protocol, but I'm okay with that. I'm okay with protocols being used in tandem, but I feel like keeping a separation of concerns in play is probably the right way to make that happen. And now I'm not a cryptographer, but
here's my concern with that. Well, for one, you won't be able to actually formally analyze it. And so what you'll do when you're formally analyzing that is you're going to say, I'm not going to try to address tampering. And so this is what TLS does in their formal analysis. TLS has actually gotten to the point where they talk specifically about accepting middle boxes, as they refer to them, which are basically just web content filters that man in the middle every connection. And so that's where I get to the point of, if we want it to be a lightweight connection, what you're proposing is another TLS. And if the solution is just use verifiable credentials, why are we going through the path of trying to set up this TLS connection if we're going to rely on verifiable credentials just being a bolt-on solution? And so, like, I'm not saying no to anything. I'm just, what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to figure out where are we differentiating and what are the differences. I can accept trade-off in any direction. I'm willing to work with anything. I just, more than anything, want to understand what's going on so I can help write this stuff up and help us give a good answer.
I mean, our thought is basically verifiable credentials are going to be necessary if you want to be certain there's no you know, if you want to be certain of who you're talking to. So we think verifiable credentials are necessary, which is why, you know, the approaches we've been looking at. So I like the idea of including it as part of it, or at least an optional part of it, maybe a decorator to say, here's a proof of who I am. The sender decides what they want to prove. They can prove anything they want, just as long as it contributes to, you know, proving that there's nobody in the middle.
Yeah.
We talked about that as a replacement for having to say, you know, self-attesting your name in a comment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was that discussion. Yeah, this is the difficulty with it, because as soon as we start talking about we're exchanging verifiable credentials, then we have to make the trade-off on size of the message that's being passed around as well. And the number of messages that have to go through to complete the exchange in this. And so, like, for example, if we're passing the verifiable credential, we just made this way outside the size of a QR code.
Right, but you're not doing that on the invitation. So the invitation is different. But this is, that would be included on the request and the response. And again, as I say, it doesn't require extra messages, because you let the connector decide what they want to prove. It may not be what you need proven, but at least you've got a proof and you have some information about them, including that there's no man in the middle. So that's where we're using that self-attested credential on what key is being used.
Yeah. So the request and the response could contain that information, and we're not particularly concerned about the size of those messages themselves.
Okay. So that solves that problem. It's good that we don't have to make a trade-off there. So then my guess is, do we talk about verifiable credential exchange in this? Because Sam, when you were talking about assuming the QR code is out of band, what I heard was that basically eliminates any QRs being loaded over a server onto a web page.
No.
So are you saying that you trust every person between your computer that loaded it onto your screen and the server that sent that image in the first place?
No, I'm not making any assertions whether we trust it or don't in this protocol. We're saying it's out of band.
Okay.
And the nature of the transfer is up to the out of band communication. So for example, if you're doing, serving a QR code over a TLS site, then you have better properties than if you're just serving it up over HTTP without, you know, HTTPS involved. So what I'm saying is that it's the transfer methods of the invitation are subject to the nature of how they're being transferred, and that's out of the scope for this particular RFC. That's totally a punt, but including every condition of every possible transport is really hard.
Which is part of the reason that I've thought about this in a different way on that, but let's put it this way. If we want to punt on that, I'm fine with that. I'm just going to caution that we may get left out of the room in certain security settings.
Well, I'm perfectly fine to include a section on like recommendations for that out of band transfer. Meaning, if it's in person, be aware of this. If it's being served up on a web page, be aware of this. You know, things like that. But I think that trying to design something to that level is not really within what we're capable of.
Okay. Yeah.
I feel like the one of the key design requirements of DIDCOM is that it be composable, meaning you can do protocol one and then you can do protocol two and you can have a sub protocol going on and all this other kind of stuff. We should distinguish between desired security properties of a context and desired security properties of a protocol. And we should also distinguish between UX of a context and UX of a protocol. So if Alice and Bob are trying to connect with one another, there may be multiple protocols involved. And by the time all the protocols are done, they should have a good user experience and achieve the security characteristics they want. That doesn't mean that the first protocol has to guarantee everything. And I don't think we'll be laughed out of the room
if we say, yeah, the first protocol's job is just X. It's not X plus Y. The second protocol is designed to provide Y.
That's correct. My thinking on this has been, though, if you design it in such a way where you allow that, then you end up in situations where the majority of users only do step one and don't actually complete protocol two, in which case, you know, it's not implemented because, right. You know, like if so somebody comes, yeah, go ahead.
The implementations that only do step one should be laughed out of the room if they're trying to accomplish something that is more significant than step one allows. That doesn't mean we have to pollute the architecture of a given protocol. It means that there's pressure on implementations to do the right thing. It would be just like if an implementation, after we did all this work to like sign all these messages and everything, if an implementation didn't check the signature, that would be really stupid. And you should be laughed out of the room for having that implementation, but there's nothing that the underlying protocol design can do to force you to check the values.
So what I'm understanding that this to mean is that we can allow somebody to shoot themselves in the foot, but everybody, there's an implied implementation detail in here that you should be doing both.
Well, you can't prevent people from doing stupid things. We can,
no, but you
try to design them to be hard to do, right? Yes, you're right. We can make them hard to do. But I think that problem is better solved. So what Daniel said, what I was trying to say, only he said it with better vocabulary. I think that when we talk about the protocol of connecting, one of the reasons why a name change to BitExchange is really helpful here is that we're not implying that what you end up with at the end of the BitExchange protocol is a connection. You end up with an exchange of DIDs. And then from an overall protocol perspective, there are other things necessary in order to make that happen. And in your worry that people will just exchange DIDs and then plow ahead without doing other protocols is like saying, well, I'm worried that people are going to use the new, you know, DNS over SSL features, right? So that they can securely look up a domain, and then they're going to load the domain without using TLS at that point. And the short answer is that's always going to be possible. We can't prevent people from not doing important things. And I do agree that we ought to minimize what's going on. But at the same time, I think that trying to make sure that this very first thing that we come up with solves all of the problems may not even be a desirable goal, even if it's possible.
Okay.
So I got a question here. If I understood this conversation, what it's sounding like is a premise to using the DIDCOM protocol is that we have previously established a secure communication pathway. If that's the case, why don't we simplify all this and say, here's my DID, use it, instead of trying to negotiate anything back and forth. And then if that's not the case, then we need to put more negotiation into this process. But that's what I got out of the discussion, was that we have to have previously established a secure communication in order to negotiate the secure communication that we're going to use.
I think the issue is
that we're trying to use, and we want to use DID peer. I think you don't have a DID that you're using to establish. You're trying to create a new DID to establish a relationship, and that is not an existing DID. And even if it was, I don't think it would give you any more secure, any more trust in the relationship.
So the question is, do we need to establish a secure communication before we start negotiating the peer DID, or can the algorithm support a handshake?
I think the problem here is that we're not clear on our goals. Let me propose a modification to what you said, Steve. This protocol in its current form does establish a secure connection. The problem is that we don't know whether the secure connection is with the party that you think it's with. So we know that at the end of this dance, we are talking to a party and we can from then on talk to that party reliably. Kyle's concern is that unless we also guarantee that the party we're talking to is the party we think we're talking to, then we're going to make foolish assumptions. I think that's a fair summary, Kyle.
Yeah, that nails it right on the head.
Okay, so the question is, what is the appropriate way to determine if the party you have just connected to is really the party you want to be connected to? And the proposed answer is ask them for a credential. We have a secure pipe. We just don't know if the party on the other end of the pipe is the one we want to talk to. When you use the connection protocol or the DID exchange protocol, you only answer the first question. So you now engage in a follow-up protocol to determine whether the party you're talking to is correct.
I've been meaning to bring that up for a while here, Daniel. I feel like it's a, you know, we're spending all this time talking about, yeah, you know, how do you determine like line of sight when you meet someone immediately that you trust them, right? Whereas it's like, yeah, in the real world, we'd like, you know, would put a certain amount of, and then, but if it gets really serious, like get out your wallet and show me what you actually really are. Right. Or, you know, give me three referrals of parties I can go to really figure it out. They're much, we have a whole new suite of tools to use, about real trust establishment that a lot of quote, you know, protocols that are purely technical can't get into. So I feel like we should always know that ultimately the DID that you get is a DID you're going to trust because of other things you can prove about that DID that have nothing to do with the original protocol from which you got that DID. And with that, I got to jump now to another meeting. So I'll just leave with that thought.
Jerome's just going to drop that and leave the room, man.
Drop his grenade and leave. I just want to point out, this concern has nothing particular to do with peer DIDs. We're noticing it with peer DIDs, but in fact, any DID that you connect with, unless you can go look up and you have some list of well-known DIDs that you want to connect with, any DID is going to have exactly the same characteristic. You know you're connected with a DID. You don't know whether the party that owns or controls that DID is actually the party you want. So
that's correct.
So to pull from Steve's language, the whole point of this DID exchange protocol is to say, here's my DID, use it. And then this is the bootstrapping step before we actually establish what we would call a connection or a trusted relationship. This is literally just the piece of doing the initial bootstrapping to make sure there is a communication channel, and then you get to verify who they are. It's not that different from TLS saying, we're going to provide a secure pipe, but I'm still going to ask you for a username and password afterwards. Right? They're two separate stages. And the reason I like separating them is because I think that the process of figuring out why I should trust you is actually really, really nuanced and will evolve over time. I might trust a company for an entirely different reason than I trust a person. And in trying to encapsulate those things inside of the DID exchange protocol, which is trying to say, here's my DID and use it, I think is a mistake of concern, separation of concerns.
So would you say that the way that we should approach this then is move DID exchange forward, move verifiable credential forward, and then write a secondary protocol called like trusted verification protocol or something that is combining the two together? And so when people come in, we can kind of reference, here's the properties you get of DID exchange, and here's the properties you get of trusted exchange. And you know, be explicitly clear about the trade-offs that a person is making between the two.
I yes, generally, but there's one particular attack that I think that we might be able to do other things besides just verifiable credential exchange that is helpful. And that comes to a man in the middle type thing. And I think that either via protocol or facilitating an out-of-band verification, we can come up with this. For example, there's a I'm forgetting which platform this showed up on, but once I started a video call over one of these, you know, apps that does the point-to-point verification, and what they gave me was, I think they called it an emoji hash. It was like four or six emojis in a row that you could tell the other person, right? And they would see the same thing on their screen, and they could detect whether that was actually there. So it's displayed on the screen. you know, as a bit of a hash of the you might say the symmetric key in use, and then they could verify the same thing on the other side. And I think we may have an opportunity after the DID exchange protocol has happened to actually have some other form of thing, either another quick flurry of messages to verify that the man in the middle doesn't exist, or that there's, it facilitates some other out of band thing that we can actually validate that. So that way, Kyle, you and I are at IW, and I scan the thing on your phone. And then when the connection is made, we have like a thing that we can hold our screens up next to each other that should say the same thing. And that way, that's a sort of a low trust way, it's not a necessarily verifiable credentials based, but it's a way to verify that I don't really, you know, the connection that we've established is independent of the trust I might have in you personally, but at least it allows the two parties involved to verify that there's not a man in the middle. Yep. So what you said generally about adding trust to exchange DIDs with verifiable credentials is correct. But I also think there's that one other opportunity that we have. And again, I think that should probably also be done after the DID exchange protocol has completed. The DID exchange protocol is simply exchanging DIDs.
I think we can do that in the DID exchange if we can add a proof inside that. That is my point, is you're not proving any business logic, all you're proving is that there's no man in the middle. And I think that actually can be done in the request response by including a verifiable a proof in it.
So can I point out the trade-offs you make in that, which is IoT use cases, if they aren't dealing in verifiable credentials, they're just using DID comms, runs into problems. And then the other trade-off I see is what happens when you don't have verifiable credentials and you're just setting up your first communication. Those are the two trade-offs I see to it. So it can't be a must.
Fair enough. Fair enough.
Well, if we can come up with a non-VC way of doing it inside the protocol, I'm also okay with that. But again, we're not trying to add any trust to the communication. We're just trying to validate the absence of a man in the middle. And in my previous working through this, I did not come up with a way to do this in an automatic fashion that did not require some out-of-band verification step.
I'm okay splitting it. What I've been driven by in this is a principle of constraint the security that matters as much as possible. So for example, like this is where I was looking at like trying to do the DIR inside of Jose and stuff is right now we're having to revalidate keys every time a message is occurring to make sure that I'm not getting man in the middle halfway through or something like that. Taking these things and trying to figure out how do we constrain this stuff as much as possible. And so if everybody kind of agrees to that principle, that helps me, to try and figure it out. If there's not agreement on that, it helps me to know what we do have agreement on.
Well, I think for my part, what I agree on is that we need to figure out a way to eliminate the man in the middle. And if the requirement is to do that out of band or put in verifiable credentials or some other algorithmic method, I think that's pretty important to do. Because putting a warning label on DIDCOM saying that it inherently contains a man in the middle attack, I don't think will fly. And so providing the solution, even if it's a multi-staged solution, is pretty important.
Yep, I agree with that.
Who's willing to attack the man in the middle detection or prevention? This is another issue that's in addition to the other ones we've talked about, and we've got all of those ones assigned out. Who's willing to do the work on to figure out what would be required to prevent man in the middle?
So I've been working on this on the sidelines. I would like some other people who are taking a look at it, but I have no problem leading the charge if I have a few other people to discuss and figure this out with.
Kyle, this is Steve McCown. I'll look it up with you.
Okay, thank you.
Hey, Kyle, this is Jack Callahan. I'll join you.
Okay, thank you.
I think the man in the middle prevention is totally within the scope of what DID exchange can contain. So if what you come up with is, hey, if we change XYZ or add A, B, and C, then we get these security properties, that is something that I would be very interested in knowing about.
Okay, sounds good. I will reach out to the both of you.
So, and I appreciate you guys volunteering and look forward to hearing back on that. In the meantime, Daniel and I will go ahead and chase down the other various aspects of this, and so that we can knock off the remaining issues about them. I might also update the DidExchange RFC with an enumeration of these issues until we actually knock them off. And that way there's a little bit better documentation on what this RFC in particular is waiting for. Okay, and with that, we're 5 minutes over time. Daniel, we didn't get to talk about your thing, and we can put that first next time. You have a test document that we didn't get to today. But I think he already left. Well, yep. I'll tell him anyway. I'll tell him next time. So thank you all for coming, and looking forward to the progress that we're making. I feel like we've had a really productive couple of meetings as we've identified issues and moved forward. Please stay active on the Aries channel and issues, and we'll get this stuff sorted out as soon as we can. Thank you all for coming.
Sounds good. Thanks, everybody.
Bye.
Bye, all.